on one bill, and we will start with House Bill 2558. And Marjorie, would you?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2558 provides that the Drug Use Review Board, in reviewing retrospective and prospective drug use, may consider only drugs that have received final approval from the FDA.
Okay. Thank you. Jim Gardner, would you come up, please?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm an attorney with the Gardner & Gardner Law Firm, and I'm appearing today for PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. This bill for which we ask your support is a very simple bill that does one thing. It prohibits the Oregon Drug Use Review Board from conducting retrospective or prospective reviews of prescription drugs that have not yet been approved by the Federal Food and Drug Administration. Why is this bill important? Because on several occasions in the past, the Oregon Drug Use Review Board, the DUR Board, attempted to preemptively list a drug as not covered under the Oregon Health Plan before that drug had even received final approval from the FDA. Passage of this bill would prevent such preemptive strikes against drugs in the FDA pipeline. Now, PhRMA is an extremely strong supporter of both the prospective and retrospective drug utilization review processes. Careful, well-informed DUR helps ensure, first, that the right drugs are being prescribed to treat the conditions of patients on the Oregon Health Plan, and second, that only conditions above the line are being covered by the plan. Indeed, the legislation which codified the entire DUR process in Oregon in 1993 was a PhRMA bill. But the DUR process is deliberately designed to evolve with ongoing medical research and clinical evidence of patient and provider experience with respect to FDA-approved drugs. The process was never intended to preemptively preclude the use of pending new drugs before they had even been approved by the FDA. Indeed, such preclusion is antithetical to the basic philosophy of the Oregon Health Plan. And that is that one of the key factors to be weighed in assigning a rank to a particular condition treatment pair on the Oregon Health Plan priority list is the treatability of the condition. And the basic idea is that completely untreatable conditions should rank low on the list. And we suggest that it is a perverse catch-22 argument to contend that a particular drug should be deemed not covered because the condition it treats is currently below the line before a determination can be made about whether the very existence of a potent new treatment, like a treatment for previously untreatable cancer, might push that condition above the line on the ground that it has now become treatable. This bill enjoyed very strong support on the House. It passed the House floor 53-4. Among those who spoke in favor of it was and spoke very eloquently, I might add, was Dr. Bates. We would commit it to your attention.
Okay. If you would stay there, because we do have another speaker, and in case there are questions arising, I'd like you to be handy. Tom Holt, would you come forward, please?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacists Association, here in opposition to House Bill 2558, essentially because this bill once again adds to restrictions on the state's ability to evaluate and manage its drug costs that in ways that private sector plans do as common practice. And as you know, we're having quite a debate about how we control drug costs. I would point out that just last week in the House Audit Committee, there was testimony from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon that one of the methods that they use in their drug review process is the preview of products pre-launch. That is, and they get data from the manufacturers oftentimes in that process. It is a legitimate way to look at prescription drugs as far as their value in the system, whether they are really a Me Too product or if they actually add value or should be used. And I would also point out that the DUR board process is one of making recommendations. OMAP can take or leave those recommendations. So with that, we would urge the committee not to approve this bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a question. Mr. Holt, I think Mr. Gardner made a very compelling argument about the Catch-22 provision. Do you want to respond to that?
Chair Morissette, Senator Walker, we certainly support people having appropriate care through the Oregon Health Plan and having access to appropriate, cost-effective drug therapy. And we don't believe that anything the DUR board is currently doing or has done has interfered with that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Other questions? Okay. Seeing none. Thank you.
Is that it?
Seeing no others testify, I will close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2558.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'd move House Bill 2558 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker moves House Bill 2558 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Comments? Do you have a comment?
Aye.
Okay, seeing no comments, would the clerk call the roll, please?
Senator Bennett?
Aye.
Senator
Heal.
Aye.
Senator
Starr.
Aye.
Senator
Walker.
Aye.
Senator Aye. Okay. House Bill 2558 passes unanimously, and I'm sure Senator Walker would love to carry this.
I'd be delighted.
Okay. Thank you. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 324.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 324 directs the Department of Administrative Services to establish a prescription drug bulk purchasing program. This bill currently has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and there's a dash one amendment from Senator Schrader that deletes the purchasing of prescription drugs for Oregon residents with limited or no insurance coverage for prescription drugs.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Schrader is going to testify, but I don't see him in the room at the present time, so turn off your telephone. God, do something I can sing to, okay? Thank you. Jim Gardner, would you please come forward? Is that
all? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't have any prepared testimony on this, but would just suggest that if this particular bill, if it's the committee's will that this bill move forward, we would like to participate in a dialogue, perhaps in the form of a work group with Senator Schrader and other interested parties on this particular one.
Thank you. Tim Nesbitt, Mary Botkin, would you please come forward? We're moving.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The testimony I'm distributing actually addresses both Senate Bill 324 and Senate Bill 875. I think my comments are relevant to both, and if it's acceptable to you, I'll proceed with my testimony on 324 and cover both bills.
Would you like to open a work session concurrently with the two bills?
Okay. I thought I opened a public hearing on Senate Bill 324. Oh, you're going to testify on 875 also? Public hearing?
Yes, Senator.
Yes.
Thank you. My name is Tim Nesbitt. I'm the president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I'm speaking for 180,000 working men and women of the unions of the AFL-CIO in Oregon. Our message today on both bills can be summarized in the following 7 points. One, healthcare costs are raising the cost of doing business in the private sector and the cost of providing services in the public and nonprofit sectors. Two, those same costs are squeezing our members' paychecks because every dollar needed to maintain health care benefits is a dollar less for wages and pensions and other benefits. 3, prescription drug costs are major drivers of health care costs. 4, prescription drug prices are often unfair and excessive. 5, we can negotiate more fair and affordable prices for prescription drugs through bulk purchasing. 6, you can help by creating a bulk purchasing entity. And 7, whatever you create should be available to all employers in the public sector, the nonprofit sector, and the private sector, because we're all struggling to deal with the same problem. There's probably no product that's more sensitive to the size and the sophistication of its purchaser than prescription drugs. The studies show that prescription drugs purchased by an uninsured person cost more than twice as much as the same medication purchased by the federal government, a large purchaser, for its VA hospitals. Big states pay less than small states when purchasing prescription drugs for their Medicaid programs, and big insurance groups pay less than small insurance groups. You should have in your packet a chart pack that demonstrates in a series of charts, first, the health care cost increases we've been experiencing in our health plans. Secondly, how those cost increases compare to other costs, like the cost of living as measured by the CPI and wage increases for low and high wage workers. Also, the proportion of the average family premium, now $663 in our bargaining units around the state, public and private sector, that goes towards health insurance, about $100 a month there. And the magnitude of the prescription drug costs in a number of our plans, including most notably the public employee benefit plan, where prescription drug costs represent 20% of total premium costs. That's a lot of money that's flowing through the state's general fund. Finally, a chart which shows the different prices paid by different purchasers. And that's where you see the documentation of the relatively low price paid by the feds for VA hospital patients and the much greater price, more than twice as high, paid by uninsured patients. And you just see this synchronicity there of the bigger you are, the better the price you get. The smaller you are, the worse, the higher the price you get. And then finally, you see in our last chart the profile of where prescription drug coverage is provided, 60% from employers, and the magnitude of the problem we have with the uninsured and the underinsured who don't have health insurance for prescription drugs, 18% of the population in Oregon. I also want to remind you of what happened when we needed large quantities of Cipro to combat the anthrax threat following 9/11. Bayer was charging $4.67 per tablet, average wholesale price, for Cipro. But the feds got them down to 75 to 95 cents, depending on volume. And Bayer still made money on the deal, since it's estimated that Bayer spends no more than 20 cents a pill to make that particular drug. I think that's a good example of what large-scale bulk purchasing can do to the price of that product. In most of our insurance plans, outpatient prescription drugs now cost anywhere from $100 to $140 per month in premiums for the average worker. The high number, I think, is one applicable to the public employee benefit plan. If we could get the same prices secured by large states for their Medicaid programs, we could cut that cost by more than 20%. The way to do that is to create a prescription drug bulk purchasing pool to enable public and private health plans to negotiate lower prices from the drug companies and allow participation by the uninsured as well. Such an approach is proposed with limited scope in Senate Bill 324 and through a pharmacy benefit manager in Senate Bill 567, which you're not hearing today. An even more effective approach is to combine bulk purchasing with an evidence-based formulary as proposed in Senate Bill 875. Now, all of our health plans have formularies, and they've been proven to be cost-effective for our health plans and fair for our members. Any serious effort to secure fair prices for prescription drugs should combine bulk purchasing with the use of a preferred drug list and appropriate safeguards for patients with special needs. All three bills I mentioned affect one or the other of these reforms, but they do so with very narrow limits on participation. Senate Bill 324 and Senate Bill 875 as drafted limit their reforms to state agencies which already benefit from volume purchasing. This limitation is unnecessary and counterproductive. The greater the participation in efforts like these, the better their success. For this reason, we strongly urge you to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 875. These amendments offer equal opportunity to all health plans, public and private, to join the effort to secure fair prices for prescription drugs and lower the cost of health care for employers and workers alike. This is an opportunity for you as a legislature to take the lead and set up an effective vehicle for public-private partnerships on reforms that are critical to the well-being of all working families in Oregon. The Dash 1 amendments are your invitation to all Oregonians to join in this effort. Please don't leave us out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions?
Sure.
Yes. Senator Menes.
Do you have any experience with bulk purchasing yourself? Does the AFL-CIO have an example of a state that has done this?
Or? Yeah, yeah.
Mr. Chair and Senator Menes, the examples we have include some of our unions who are on a national level have been setting up bulk purchasing. There's a laborers plan called Labor RX, where the laborers union has been attempting to do so for on a national basis among their unions. We have the examples of large states, California and Florida, with their Medicaid programs, and we have the example of multi-state efforts now being formed in the Midwest and Northeast. In all of those cases, there have been effective reductions. I can't give you. I don't come equipped with the numbers to give you the comparisons.
I want to get in my own mind what the concept is that we're trying to adopt here and how it, what the mechanics of it might be. That's why I asked if you had experience in particular with it. So.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Botkin. I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And I actually have to give you a bit of a disclaimer. I had not planned on testifying today. I am actually the older, taller version of Ken Allen, our executive director. And so what I did is at the last minute pull together some quick information for the committee, and I want to share that with you now. We do have some experience.
Which bill are you going to be talking about?
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, I'd like to speak to both 324 and 875.
Okay. Thank you.
We actually have some experience with some bulk purchasing, though not for our members. We have experience working with our members through the Department of Corrections and through the Oregon State Hospital for bulk purchasing for inmates and patients through the state hospital. And the Department of Corrections right now participates in a 41-state consortium to purchase drugs. What I did not get is the comparators, and I'm still waiting for those numbers, and I will share it with the committee and your members as soon as I have them. But we also have an equally efficient delivery system throughout the institutions. As you know, drugs in the institutions must be delivered effectively, safely, and in a controlled environment. We distribute over 300,000 prescriptions per biennium. And we represent the folks who actually dispense those prescription drugs to the clients that we have there in the institutions. We understand the need for efficiency, and we also understand the need for making improvements in the way that state government delivers their services. And we think that this bill or these bills provide us with an opportunity to kind of take the experiences we've had at the Department of Corrections and use them as maybe, if not a model, at least as an example of how bulk purchasing can be done and how it can work on a broader basis. Like everybody else, our union is facing 19% to 20% increases in health care every time we sit down at the table to bargain. I know that Senator Menes has had the same experience in Portland with the rising health care costs and the pressure that it puts upon us with the overall economic package. And anything that we can do to find a way to reduce a piece of our health care costs is something that we should leap at the opportunity to do. We would encourage you to not only include state employees, but also to include local governments and the uninsured. And, you know, we think that the bigger the base, the better the deal. And we should get the best deal we can and make it available, make those drugs available to as many people as possible at the lowest cost that we can get as a state. And the state, I mean, the state just spends an incredible amount of money on prescription drugs every year, and we need to figure out a way to reduce those costs in a way that does not compromise the care or the treatment of the clients who depend upon those prescription drugs to maintain their daily lives.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, sir.
Senator Schrader, would you come up, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Senator Kurt Schrader, Senate District 20, here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 324. Appreciate the committee hearing this bill. This is a bill I've worked on for two sessions. And the scope of my bill, as you can well see, is perhaps not as broad as some of those that have testified so far. Very simply, a bill to give the Department of Administrative Services the opportunity to establish a prescription drug bulk purchasing program. It saved money across this country. Various state agencies already do some of this. The intent of this bill is simply to make sure that all state agencies do it. As co-chair of Ways and Means for the 72nd Assembly, I'm very interested in any cost savings we can get. It's time to institute a bulk purchasing bill, at least at the public agency level, to get the ball rolling, to see we can contract with the PBM, do it in-house. The bill provides opportunities both ways. I think the problem I ran into last session was, frankly, I became aware of all the different turf battles that were out there. Different agencies had different programs that they seemed very wedded to, and what we need is, frankly, a statewide system, one that gets the advantage of more people in the system with an opportunity to have, quite frankly, a little better discount. It's worked very well for Kaiser, obviously. It works great for the VA. Our program, as it starts out, would be obviously on a much more modest scale. Maybe we partner with some other states. There's lots of ways to go about this. But we won't know about the savings or have any opportunity to examine how it works in the state of Oregon unless we move something forward. We're getting to the point in session here where bills need to move forward. I'd appreciate it if any interest the committee has, some amendments that are needed to bring this bill forward to move out. I'd appreciate input on that. I'm open to those sorts of suggestions. But I hate to lose the opportunity after two sessions of moving a bill forward that could save the state a considerable amount of money and certainly virtually no harm to begin to administer and see if we can get somewhere. As co-chair Ways and Means, again, I think the House Audit Cost Containment Committee is looking to this bill to help get some of the savings that they're talking about, and the time is frankly now, I think, to move things forward. So I'd be looking for direction from the committee and appreciate your hearing the bill.
Thank you. Question? Yes. Senator Menes.
Honorable co-chair. A couple of questions. I'm not sure that I have a problem with the concept of bulk purchasing in general, but I've got a series of questions here. It seems to me that as a state, we can already do this. We don't need a bill to do it. And you can simply do it by the governor compelling the agencies to work together for this purpose, which then, absent that prohibition, knowing that the state agencies can currently do it, I have to get to my underlying assumptions as to what the motivation is for the bill, which is where I think the devil is in the details, because I think as people are present here today, assuming that they would have access to lower-cost medications, there are some interesting things going on with respect to Senate Bill 819 from the last legislative session, where that particular bill was a practitioner-managed prescription drug benefit program that had inherent in it the ability of a physician or a practitioner who's allowed to prescribe medicines to choose in the best interest of their patient any medication. But the current climate and move by various individuals in this state is to attempt to preclude the effect of that bill, contrary to legislative intent, contrary to the construct of that bill, in the creation of a, or the use of a PBM that includes prior authorization, which is consistently inconsistent with the work of the Legislative Assembly during the 2001 Legislative Assembly. So if we look at bulk purchasing, and if we're looking at this in the interest of just saving money, then I think theoretically you've got a point. You could probably save money. But I think people who are assuming that they are going to then be benefited by this have to be careful, because there are traps for the unwary here, in that by using PBMs, by using formulary or prior authorization, what happens to the patient is you take out of the control of the physician the ability to prescribe a specific drug, or you set up barriers over which the drug would not be accessible. So if you're a patient and you receive a particular drug prescribed by your rheumatologist, or if you have some other kind of chronic disease where particular anti-inflammatory NSAID might work, the particular construction that we're engaged in here may not necessarily allow you access to that NSAID or that particular drug that your physician thinks you ought to have. Because inherent in the PBMs and inherent in formularies, and I'm going to get to evidence-based issues pretty quick, are these barriers that are built in. So the question, I guess I'm saying all of this to say, are my underlying assumptions correct that we're really trying to have bulk purchases so we might have bargaining power, but then also we're going to run the persons who have access to medications we're going to run the gauntlet, basically. We're going to force them into prior authorization. We're going to force them into the use of generic drugs, notwithstanding the physician's view as a practitioner that another drug might be in their best interest. That's a trap for the unwary. PBMs are infamous for this kind of thing, and the contracts that might be let as a result of that are also. So now let me get just briefly to evidence-based issues. If we're talking about actually applying evidence-based methodologies that scientists use around the country with respect to which drugs might end up on the formulary, I might be happy with that. But the information that I get back from physicians in practice who are also research, they do research, clinical research, tell me that the evidence-based methodologies used in our current endeavors are quite opposite national standards. So again, for all of those individuals who here might think that they're going to get access to the drug that really, really works for them, be careful, because there are traps for the unwary here. So perhaps you can shed some light on what your direction is, Mr. Co-Chair, and where you want to go with this, and whether or not you want to, I guess, represent the best interests of the patients or the best interests of the state. And just, is our objective just to save money, or is it to serve a constituent base?
Appreciate the question, Mr. Chair. Senator Menace, as the good senator may remember, I was a reluctant supporter of the previous governor's original intent, and it wasn't until certain senator's bill came forward, Senate Bill 19, that I felt comfortable voting for the practitioner-based reference that we have theoretically here right now. I think this good senator answers his own basic question as to, geez, if we can already do this, why do we need the bill? I think Senate Bill 819 is a good example where, you know, one tries to encourage the proper behavior, if you will, and have state government take advantage of the most opportunities that we do have, which is to bulk purchase. There are some counterintentions. That does happen, I think. Different people, for very good reasons, within state government, without state government, have different views about how things should be done. But if we don't go down and give, I think, clear direction, I've seen this, I'm sure as you have, on many bills where unless you give very clear direction, agencies are sometimes reluctant to move forward, reluctant to take that step and make the necessary changes that we have to have. I do not look at this as a bill that would be restrictive in terms of practitioners making the ultimate choice for what drug is the best for that particular patient. That has never been my point. But this bill, I think, is a narrower concept. I don't see it as an outgrowth of or an addition to the 819 process dealing with reference-based or practitioner-based formularies. What I'm most interested in, I'm a simple little old budget person, and I'm just really interested in helping the state of Oregon perform like it should. And to be absent a bulk purchasing program, or at least the embryonic form thereof, I think is a huge neglect on our state's part when we're talking about doing all the cost containment that we could humanly possibly do. This bill is fairly narrow in scope at this point in time. I'm not sure that a broader bill actually gets out of this particular building. I'm open to the committee's wisdom in that regard, but I think it's very important to start down this trail, particularly with regard to state agencies, break down the walls and the turf battles and get this process rolling, and I am interested in cost containment and cost savings for the state and the people of this great state.
Yes. Senator, I do appreciate your comments, and I heard you say that you want a clear direction, and you did not favor a restrictive methodology, and I respect your answer. I would disagree that you are just a simple little budget person, given your training and background. So, but thank you very much for testifying. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we have a public hearing open for two bills, that which includes Senate Bill 875. Pardon me?
I have to represent
here. Yeah. Okay. We will, I guess, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 324, and we will open. Keep the public hearing on Senate Bill 875. Representative Greenlick, would you come up, please? Bruce Goldberg, Lynn Marie Kreider, you can come up together.
I'm Mitch Greenlick, representative from House District 33. I appreciate the opportunity to testify this afternoon. Thank you. And I'm going to testify both, I think, a little bit about the political side of this and about the technical side from my experience before I started spending a lot of time in this building. Many of us campaigned on the question of bulk purchasing. And as Senator Minnis said very clearly, bulk purchasing has a lot of context, but particularly when we're talking about the Dash 1 amendments to 875, Senator Morris and my bill, I think this really gives us an omnibus chance to think about bulk purchasing in the state in its broadest context. We all receive emails, at least I do, and I suspect you all do, about how the state needs to be more businesslike and how we need to accept practices from the business world into the way the state behaves. What this Dash 1 amendments to SB 875 does, I think, is to provide the state the opportunity to behave the way businesses behave in dealing with the question of the purchasing of pharmaceuticals. There is one thing that moves prescription prices, and that's the ability to change the market share in the drug world. The drug companies are very much interested in market share, and the power to move market share is what defines your ability to get good prices on prescription drugs. Senator Minnis asked about prior experiences, and I had two prior experiences in my lifetime that really frame my perspective on the creation of a bill like the Dash 1 amendments to 875. For 32 years, I was the research director for Kaiser Permanente, for Kaiser Foundation Hospitals. And I had come to that position from an earlier life as a professor of pharmacy management at Wayne State University in Detroit, with a lot of interest in the question of the pharmacy industry and in how to make drugs most available for our clients. Kaiser Permanente now has I don't know, 6 or 7 million members, some large number, and through the activities that have happened over the last 25 years, 30 years there, they now, as my understanding, have the lowest prices of pharmaceuticals of any non-governmental agency in the United States, and that's because they are able to move market share for a significant number of people. I created the first formulary for Kaiser Permanente in, I think it was 1969 or something like that, a long time ago when I was still young and foolish, and worked for many years with the physicians to create a model that would allow clinically controlled decisions on the use of drugs, but to still bring the kind of consolidation of purchasing power that's envisioned in the -1 amendments to 875 into the world. The basic notion is that clinicians make the decisions on what's effective, what's efficacious, and what's effective, and that there are always safeguards in the system that allows a clinician to make the ultimate decision over the pharmaceutical use by his or her patients. The basic idea, though, is to make sure that the easiest process is the one to make the most effective choice first, and that while it's always a physician decision, ultimately, there you organize a system in a way to make it easier for a physician to do the right thing. We've carried this further. The earlier decisions that you have in the 70s and 80s in the creation of formularies were pretty much by guess and by gosh. There was a variety of ways where physicians talked to each other, worked out the kind of nitty-gritty, and made ultimate decisions after talking to many of their colleagues. We now have moved to the evidence-based world, and there are particular strategies for defining evidence-based, some of which were defined at Oregon Health Sciences University in their Evidence-Based Practice Center, and some of which have been defined at other universities around the country. So what underlies 875, and Bruce and Lynn Marie will talk more about that, is the notion of how do we move market share. And what 875 does is allow the state to bring to bear its purchasing power along with the purchasing power of a variety of other groups, the people in the state who don't have prescription insurance, the self-insurers of the state, perhaps even insurance companies and health and welfare trusts, people who are out in the private sector and would like to combine with the state to bring together the kind of purchasing power that in just the regular business world of pharmaceutical marketing allows them to create a better price structure. I think that's all I'll say in introduction. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you here, and I'll be here to answer questions either before or after Lynn Marie and Bruce have a chance to talk.
Thank you. Who wants to go first?
I guess okay. The representative is handing me the microphone, so I'll take it. For the record, my name is Bruce Goldberg. I am the administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research. I'm here to make a few comments regarding Senate Bill 875-1. What I wanted to speak to is really the population for which this bill is aimed. There are a large number of individuals in this state that are what I would characterize as pharmaceutically uninsured. We know that we have about 470,000 Oregonians without health insurance today. We have approximately 500,000 individuals in this state who are on Medicare. Medicare does not provide a prescription drug benefit. Clearly, there are many Medicare recipients who buy supplemental coverage that does cover their pharmaceuticals, but there are a substantial number of Medicare recipients that don't have pharmaceutical drug coverage. There's also a number of individuals in the state who have high deductible health care policies, which means their first dollar coverage, a high proportion of their first dollar coverage, often goes towards buying prescription drugs. This bill is really aimed at setting up a voluntary purchasing cooperative so that those people that need prescription drugs can get access to prescription drugs at a better price. This is really about setting up something that hopefully allows citizens within our state, as well as small businesses and other purchasers of health insurance, such as Lynn Marie will talk to, access to a better price for pharmaceuticals. Thank you very much.
Okay, question?
Never, I'm not going to engage the doctor in this discussion right now, but later, perhaps.
You got all the experts here, John.
Well, I'm getting back to my original discussion about which drugs. Because if you set up a system that forces people into generics or bad choices and physicians don't have the ability, or you set up an onerous system that precludes physicians from reasonably accessing medications for their patients, then, yeah, we save money, and I think we would, but I think patients would be harmed. Because physicians do what physicians do, and they've got a lot of people in and out of the door, and they're going to make the quickest, easiest decision. And that's a problem.
Chair Morissette, Senator Minnis, we've had some of this discussion, and I agree with you that we've got to be able to craft things that are in the best interests of the citizens, and that I believe that we've become, in many ways, the political discourse about how to sort of do some of the pharmaceutical management in the state has sort of become polarized between an all or none argument. I agree with you, and we've had this discussion, that we do need to maintain the choice of physicians. I think we need to provide information to physicians. I think we need to be cognizant of the fact that not every medicine works for the same people in the same way. I think that we've got to take those factors into account. I think we also have to take into account evidence and best practices, and we have to create a way, I think, as Representative Greenlick spoke to, that we can, on one hand, look to make it easy for physicians and patients to have the choices that are directed by the best evidence made, and at the same time create the kinds of exceptions so that people don't have to just follow one path. And I think that when we talk about those sorts of issues, that we need to all sit down and think about how we can craft those things. I think that really this bill is less about the sort of issues of prior authorization and formularies, and actually more about how do we put together a voluntary purchasing cooperative to get people the best price possible.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Doctor, I would respectfully disagree with you, because I worked in good faith last session with a particular physician who also happened to be governor, who made particular promises and commitments. And I carried a bill on the floor with a certain understanding that things would be a certain way. And the agency, or agencies, are doing it differently and saying, oh, gosh, gee whiz, we have legal counsel that says we can't. Well, you know, I got to tell you something. Before, as a senator, I'm going to be willing to move forward on something. I'm going to make sure that we've addressed some of those issues. And I got to tell you, prior authorization was an issue that was not allowed, specifically addressed on the Senate floor and the floor of the House of Representatives with 819. And I think that this is a trap for the unwary if we don't explore some of these issues. I'm with you if bulk purchasing saves money, however, comma, if we don't address some of the other issues. Then I'm not with you. I'm not willing to go there, because this is not a simple bulk purchase bill. This is related to entire systems of distribution and access to health care for for people in the state of Oregon. As 875 is envisioned, it would be. And I would agree with the principle, but I would not agree with the obstruction of access by governments. And I've been here in this building since 1985, where we were doing sentencing and corrections policy based on revenue. That is a bad idea. And it's a bad idea to do pharmaceutical constructs and statute based on revenue. Now, let me ask you this other question, too, because, Doctor, you're much more familiar, obviously, with medical science than I am, but you have the Human Genome Project and the research going on with various compounds. It seems to me that as this work goes forward, it's even more important to maintain flexibility in the system in the event that new compounds are available. And it seems to me that it's important because when new compounds are discovered, you have the ability to reduce hospitalization, emergency room visits, and a whole series of other issues that are related. And I can give you an example of methotrexate that is authorized for arthritis, for rheumatoid arthritis. There's a new drug called Enbrel. They work very differently. I mean, they work, but one's kind of Stone Age and the other one's very, very advanced. At least since I take Enbrel, it stops the disease in its tracks. Methotrexate literally makes you into an emotional wreck, because I've taken it too. But as you move along in medical science, the treatments are changing for rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, different types of diseases, including leukemia, and so on and so forth. But as these drugs become available, if all the government does is say, we're going to do bulk purchases, and we're going to force people into a generic route, and, oh, by the way, they're just the poor. They're just those individuals who don't have health insurance. And, oh, by the way, it's too expensive, so we're not going to allow them access to these kind of drugs. I think we've done a harm to a population that I believe deserves a chance.
Chair Morissette, Senator Minnis, I totally agree with you that if we force vulnerable people or actually anybody into the point where they're getting the wrong medicines that are not appropriate to treat them, then we've done people a disservice. I'm in total agreement with you around that. I think that we need to maintain the kinds of flexibilities to be able to allow people to get the medications that they need. I hope that this bill isn't a trap. I guess you don't know whether something's a trap until you've been caught in it. If it is a trap and if it's sort of being seen as something that it's not, I'd hope we can all work together to figure out some ways to have it meet, I think, some of the objectives that we're all talking about. How to get the right medicines to the right people at the best price. And I think that that's something we need to work on doing and figure out how to do that.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Doctor. The relating clause on this bill is wonderfully broad and allows for great opportunities to rectify some perhaps vague language that might have existed, and I would be more than happy to work with clarifying and tightening up some previously bad language.
I wonder if I might comment.
Yes,
Mr. Chair, could I ask you question?
Yes.
Briefly, Senator Testimony. Sorry, Representative Greenwood. You indicated that you didn't want anybody to get the wrong medications. Does that include perhaps the fact that some people have different responses to generic drugs than to a brand med drug?
Senator Morissette, Vice Chair Fisher, absolutely. I think that individuals do metabolize things differently, and in those cases where someone does indeed have a different metabolism or a different response to something that is either that's inappropriate or contraindicated, that no one should be forced to do something that's shown and documented to be harmful to somebody. We wouldn't want to make someone take a medication that they were allergic to, that they had untoward side effects from. I think the issues around some of these is working through some of those and being able to create the circumstances so that someone wouldn't be made to take a medicine that wasn't appropriate for them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. If I might comment, too. This is a really important discussion, and I don't think there's anybody, certainly at this table, or anybody, I hope, that will be presenting yet in this hearing, that thinks these decisions should be made by anybody but physicians. The issue is, How do you move towards getting rational prescribing among physicians? And the truth is, this is an evolving world. If you go to places where you think about medical care being the best, the Mayo Clinic, the Lovelace Clinic, major university centers nowadays, more and more the prescribing patterns are being emerged by the physicians, talking to each other, bringing evidence into their decision, having computers in front of them when they treat patients that give them the latest information on drugs, side effects, costs, information. The way a physician a decade from now, when this bill, if it's passed, would really be implemented, the whole question of how medical practice would be different. I mean, we'll have physicians using computer-assisted information systems that we're developing at OHSU and a variety of other places that build in the best clinical information. That's information designed by physicians talking to each other and using scientific information. And it almost invariably moves us down a path from starting with the simplest and the time-honored way of medicine, the so-called Occam's razor. You start with the simplest and the least complex, and you move by stages to the more complex. Usually when you do this model, particularly when it's guided by physicians, the prescribing patterns of physician increases enormously. And it does, as Senator Minnis said, have to take in the true meaning of what cost-effectiveness is. And cost-effectiveness is effectiveness including the reduction of hospitalization, the reduction of return visits, the whole gamut of the effect of a prescribing pattern on healthcare and on healthcare costs. What this bill does is it brings us to the place that most modern places that are now providing medical care do. They mostly have formulas. They're mostly physician-driven. There's mostly places to get out of a formulary when a physician needs to because of the specific reactions of the patients. And there's still the question of resource allocation built into that clinical model as we are now training 21st century physicians to do.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay. See you next. Yes.
Yes, sir. Representative, I do not disagree with what you just said, but where's the part of the bill that really does that, bringing physicians' practice decision making to a higher level? I don't see it in the bill.
Senator Morris, Senator Minnis. My point is that this is evolving as a part of the way healthcare is evolving. What this bill does is what most modern healthcare systems are now doing. It provides the bulk purchasing and the scientific information that feeds into the physician decision modeling. And the question of the way medical care is evolving, as long as we make sure, I was moved by your sense of the world not being the way it was intended to be. We need to make sure as we build that into these kind of models that we're not doing it to interfere with clinical practice. We're doing to improve clinical practice and doing it with the clinicians being in charge of these kind of decisions.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
If I can beg your indulgence. Again, I don't disagree with you all. It's not in the bill. It might be appropriate to talk about it and maybe put it in the bill because as we dealt with Senate Bill 819, physicians, my own included, who is a practitioner who does research with her husband, who's also a physician in another practice area, who's also a professor at OHSU, was precluded from participating with the very group here that we're going to give the power to do some of this stuff, the Oregon Health Policy Research, because she actually did research, God forbid, on behalf of or in conjunction with pharmaceutical manufacturers. Now, if what you're saying is true, and that's where you really want to go, and I have absolutely no reason to doubt you because I agree with you, why wouldn't we put it in the bill and allow the pharmaceutical manufacturers to participate in helping to develop that evidence-based material? Because if we're doing it as a government and we're picking and choosing what evidence works and what evidence doesn't and what should be included and what should, then what you're telling me based on this, the construct in this bill, is physicians are going to get a very limited amount of information.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I've worked with drug companies in a variety of studies that work to create drugs, hypertension, osteoporosis, and a variety of things. I've also, as associate director of the Evidence Based Practice Center, done reviews where the information from drug companies, as long as it's open and scientifically valid, have been fed into this process. I believe the modern way that we do evidence reviews brings evidence from wherever it comes, and that includes work sponsored by drug companies, sponsored by the NIH, sponsored by...
Mr. Chairman, again, you would not be opposed to bringing the pharmaceutical manufacturers and their information base into this discussion?
Absolutely not.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Okay. Senator Shields.
Representative Greenlick, a few minutes ago, as you very eloquently described the model,
what?
I was hearing you say that you know, cost-effective has to be defined in the broadest sense of the word, and that would account for the differences in patients and clients, and it would account for, you know, effective, cost-effective in terms of if you use one drug that doesn't quite make it and somebody returns to an unhealthy state because it isn't as efficacious as it should be or whatever. My heart soared when I was listening to that. And then I hear Senator Minnis say, but it's not in the bill. You know? How do I deal with this? I want this description to become a reality because you said it well. How, you know, do you get where I'm coming from here?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I would love to keep your heart soaring because
well,
I think...
And that's the challenge
and in fact,
of the day.
All of our hearts need to keep soaring, which means we need to be looking for ways to build the future system. And where we are now is we spend too much time looking back to the day that I was in a drugstore shaking pills out and hoping it was the right bottle I was pouring it out of and, you know, looking at this prescription that I could barely read into where we're moving. And what I think we're doing with this bill is beginning to provide the modern tools that, in fact, are being used everywhere in the United States now. This is not some radical new idea. I mean, the kind of things that we're talking about here are used by the best healthcare systems right now for people who choose those healthcare systems and pay a lot of money to get their care in them. What we need to make sure while we're doing that, and this is the point, that we keep this in a common sense model. There's a saying in medical education that we try and train physicians right away with that says, always look for a horse, don't look for a zebra. And the problem with prescribing patterns is that we don't start with the common and move to the least common. That frequently we just, oh, here's a new drug, let's try that, whether that makes sense or it doesn't make sense. So this is not a utopian model we're building. This is essentially a common sense model that you see in the Dash 1 amendments that's used all over the country in Kaiser and a variety of other Mayo Clinic and a variety of other places. How do we build in this common sense? How do we make sure we don't do anything that shoots down your soaring heart by dealing with the details, which can be very destructive, is I think the challenge, and I think we need to work hard on that.
Mm-hmm. Good, thank you. This has the makings of a work group. We'll get to that in a little while. Lynn Marie.
Mr. Chairman, I was asked to do the technical piece of walking through the bill, and it we're kind of in the middle of the discussion, so it's an odd place to do that, but perhaps it's useful anyway. I also want to be able to speak to a couple of the issues that we've been discussing here, and I'll tell you when I'm going off into the margin and I'm no longer doing the technical description of the bill, but talking to some of these issues. I'm looking at the what I've been asked to go through is the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 875, and I think you all have those before you. I also prepared a two-page summary that takes it topic by topic and then refers you back to the bill, and I won't be going through that, but you may find that useful later on. As you know, these amendments replace the existing content of the bill. Section 1, sub 1 of the bill describes what the purpose of the program is. That is, it's to have the Department of Administrative Services establish the bulk purchasing program, to purchase prescription drugs, that is, to negotiate the prices and rebates that would be paid by participants in the program, to make available prescription drugs at the lowest possible cost, and to maintain a list of prescription drugs, that is a preferred drug list, that includes the most effective prescription drugs available at the best possible prices. So by maintain, we're saying not only to create it initially, but to do the kind of periodic review of the list and updating of the list that is currently done by health plans that have preferred drug lists. I would note as a sidebar that the most effective is the language that was used in Senate Bill 819, that when those reviews, when the list is put together now, that process of determining effectiveness includes, and I'm serving on one of the subcommittees right now, it includes looking at, does the drug do what it's supposed to do, i.e. in the case of drugs that are cholesterol-lowering drugs, does it lower cholesterol? But also, what happens in terms of adverse events? Are we having side effects? Are there more side effects with certain drugs than other drugs? What are the long-term outcomes in terms of heart attacks that would land somebody in the hospital? Now, it may be that the committee would like to have that spelled out, that we don't just talk about effectiveness, but we define that to include the range of concerns that Senator Shields referred to. Section 1, sub 2 of the bill at line 12 states what the Oregon Department of Administrative Services is required to do and lists these functions that are part of any kind of purchasing program: to negotiate price discounts and rebates, to purchase the drugs or reimburse pharmacies for the drugs so that there may be that the money is not flowing through the department itself, to work with pharmacies to make the negotiated prices available to participants in the program, to establish and manage a network of pharmacies that would be used. That's what a health plan does. It creates a network of pharmacies that people can go to pick up the drugs under the plan. On page 2, to adopt and maintain a preferred drug list, to develop a system for making sure that the costs of the program are allocated to the participants, that is, so that the administrative cost of running the program gets charged back to those who are buying through the program. So that's not a cost that is borne by the state, but rather by the participants in the program, and to cooperate with other states or regional purchasing bodies that may assist in getting doing the job of the purchasing program more effectively. Section 1, sub 3, at page 2, line 12, says that the DOS shall purchase for entities that decide they want to be part of the program, and it lists those. State agencies that either purchase directly for drugs, like Department of Corrections, or indirectly, like a program that does an insurance kind of program, like PEB. It actually specifically lists the Public Employee Benefits Board. Residents of Oregon who have limited or no insurance coverage. Local governments and special government bodies like school districts, which captures local governments and so forth that have self-insured programs or that purchase for their county jails, that kind of thing. And then E, which is page 2, line 24, any other entity that directly or indirectly purchases prescription drugs. So that catches your self-insured private employers, your health plans if they wish to participate, and so on. Section 2 indicates, again, that participation is voluntary. Excuse me?
Senator Menes?
And you skipped over on line 12, I assume not intentionally, but the language, it says, and distribute. What is that supposed to mean? How is that envisioned to occur?
How does the distribution occur?
Right. Are we building an entire distribution infrastructure within the state government? Because then it goes on to say, or reimburse pharmacies, or I assume distribution. So, because this language here is broad enough to allow the state to actually develop its own distribution system.
That language does seem to suggest that breadth of authorization. At the bottom of page one, line 23, they are to establish and manage a network of retail pharmacies. I think the understanding of the proponents of the amendments is that existing retail pharmacies would be utilized rather than creating a new competing system to distribute. But perhaps that could be clear.
I was asked whether I wanted to go back to my former life and start a chain of storefront pharmacies. That was not what we intended. You wrote that. It was much more intended to be Walgreens and Rite Aid and these other stores in a network.
All right. So, Mr. Chairman, intent is not to create a separate and distinct government-sponsored distribution
system. Nor a new distribution system.
All right, thank you.
Although maybe between the sessions. No.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Miss, probably fine.
Make everybody nervous.
Let's see. Page 3, line 4, the department shall provide a mechanism to calculate and transmit prices through the pharmacy. Basically, we're saying the negotiation process goes on, but the rebates need to flow through to the pharmacies or to the purchasers. They're not held by the state as the purchaser. Pharmacies would be able to charge a professional dispensing fee, as they do under any kind of pharmacy program. Sub 4 at line 10 is the language that allows the program to use methods of managing pharmacy benefits, such as prior authorization systems. And I might step aside from my walkthrough at that point and to note that obviously, there are all kinds of prior authorization systems that might be established under this broad language. It would seem to cover anything from the notion that a physician can override on the prescription pad to something that requires the physician to actually get approval from someone in order to take them out of the list. And I would note for you that in a similar program that the legislature of the state of Vermont adopted earlier this year, so I can't tell you anything about how it's actually operating, but the language of that bill actually spells out in more detail the nature of the prior authorization that the legislature had in mind, and I can share that with the committee. It might be helpful to you because it made it clear that there would be a process by which there would be a preferred drug list, a conversation that had to take place, but that the physician ultimately had the power to make the final decision rather than some third party. So I'd be happy to share that with you.
Well, Lynn, if you're a physician, I'm not a physician, but I talk to, and looking at health plan, the Oregon health plan, what I understand the dynamic to be now is a lot of physicians are moving Oregon health plan patients through their offices in larger volume than they do persons who have outside insurance or are self-pay, and that's because of the reimbursement rates and a whole host of other things. But tell me, if you have a prior authorization methodology, how does a physician take the time from the room where they're doing their examination and they've concluded a diagnosis that they then call a phone number or get somebody on the phone that says, okay, doctor, you want to prescribe the following medication, what's your justification, what's your diagnosis, and why would you prescribe this? And I don't know how this would work, but I'm assuming there would be a dialogue and some justification. So if you're really talking about interjecting in the practice of medicine a series of phone calls, and I'm thinking, and this may not apply to your union members, it may, but that now you've set up a barrier for the patient to actually have access to the physician, because what physician who's now already feeling that they're not getting reimbursed at the right rate now has to take an extra 5 minutes or even 10 minutes out of their schedule to wait for a return call or get on the phone to a pharmacy benefit management company or wherever they are to get that authorization?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, let me make a response, and then I'd really like to hand it off to Dr. Goldberg, who does this, and I don't, because I'm not a physician. I would say two things. One, that most of our members are on plans that include prior authorization processes, and maybe Dr. Goldberg can tell you what those are like. Our belief is that when you have a well-constructed preferred drug list, that most people will be able, it will be medically appropriate to prescribe the preferred drug for most people, obviously not all. And so the prior authorization process is designed to deal with those exceptions. And if in fact most people can't be appropriately treated with the preferred drug, then it oughtn't to be, it seems to me, a preferred drug at all, but rather that the formulary ought to be quite entirely open with respect to that class of drugs. But if I may, Dr. Goldberg.
Chair Marset, Senator Minnis, Lynn Marie, I think, gave some of the basics. One, I just wanted to back up. I would actually hope, Senator Minnis, that physicians that are treating Oregon Health Plan patients are treating them actually no differently than they treat anyone else. I'd like to believe, actually, that's what's happening, is that physicians are treating less Oregon Health Plan patients than the fact that they're treating them differently. We'd hope that physicians, and it's my belief that hopefully the great majority of physicians, in fact every physician, is treating everyone and giving everyone the time and attention they need, regardless of what their insurance is. Having said that, I do think you made a good point about some of the bureaucracy that can go on. Well constructed drug lists should make it so that the ability to prescribe the best drug occurs seamlessly and effortlessly in the vast majority of cases, and that would seem to me to be able to occur in 90% of the cases. The issue is what to do about the exception, and you're correct in that actually asking busy providers to pick up the telephone and figure out how to get an exception is time-consuming. There are ways that some of those exceptions can actually be programmed in electronically to, pharmacy management systems so that they occur without a telephone call. In other words, someone who has been taken one drug, if that drug actually, a claim for that exists in a system, and it's the next drug, that happens actually seamlessly. I think that we've got to work to the point that we minimize that as best as possible. I actually believe that well-constructed drug lists should keep this to an absolute minimum. And then what we need to do is work on ways to take those very few exceptions and make that as effortless as possible. I don't think anyone's designed a perfect system yet. And I'm not here to say that one exists. And I also don't think that we can or should wait for perfection. I think what we need to do is do the best we can with the tools we have and create the kinds of safeguards that we've been talking about and sit down and be able to craft those.
Thank you.
I'll try to whip through the rest of it, Mr. Chairman. Section 3 of the bill on page 3 simply assigns the task of creating the preferred drug list to the Office for Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research to develop and recommend it, to DOS to adopt it, and it instructs them about how that task should be done. Section 4 creates a fund so that the monies are maintained separate from the general fund. Section 5 is the rulemaking authority for DOS to manage the program. Section 6, an appropriation line. As I indicated before, the bill contemplates that the ongoing costs of the program would be paid by participants in the program, but startup costs, undoubtedly, some would be required, and Section 6 provides for that, and 7, of course, an emergency clause.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Go ahead. We're going to skip ahead a bit from the sign-up sheet, and so will Jim Gardner and Tim Holt come up? Tom Holt, I'm sorry, come up, please. We're running out of time, and I want to hear from some opposition ideas, about some opposition ideas, and with the hope that as a result of this hearing we will have a work group that Senator Minnis will head up and put the and try to reconcile 8:15. No, not 8:15. 8:19. 8:19. Try to reconcile some of the differences, because I know that we are all, you know, we're trying to come to a better system and create a system that works, and we do obviously have to include everybody in this conversation, and at some point he will carry this bill on the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. In my wildest dreams, right?
Carried 8:19.
Oh, you carried 8:19. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, representing Pharma. And I didn't say this before, but I just a brief thumbnail. Pharma represents the nation's leading research-based pharmaceutical and biotechnology companies, which discover and develop the majority of new medications used in the United States and around the world. In 2001, our member companies brought 32 new prescription drugs and biologics to market, including medicines for diseases that affect millions of patients, such as Alzheimer's, AIDS, cancer, glaucoma, heart disease, and schizophrenia. In addition, the pharma member companies invested more than $30 billion in research and development last year alone to create medicines that help combat diseases that threaten the well-being of Americans and help reduce the economic loss caused by an ailing workforce. As a practical matter, Senate Bill 875-1's proposed prescription drug bulk purchasing program for multiple state health plan populations may not meet the medical needs of individual patients. Diverse populations populations have unique clinical needs that must be met in their own distinctive manner. For instance, because Medicaid patients may have multiple diseases or may be disabled, their medical needs may differ from those of patients in the public employee system, which may again be different from those of prison inmates. In the same manner, one state's population's needs and demographics could vary greatly from another. Bulk purchasing may address the prescription drug needs of one patient population at the expense of another. Additionally, many of these benefit programs have designated coverage requirements or benefit plans intended to meet the unique health care needs of those populations. States may find it more complicated than they anticipate to combine negotiations for each population without compromising the quality of care and the integrity of program benefits. In particular, the federal Medicaid program has specific legal requirements relating to the medical care of a population with special medical needs. And in addition to those specific legal requirements, it also has a specific guarantee of best price, which is aimed at capturing the results of the negotiations that go on in the private sector and by virtue of a federal mandate guaranteeing those benefits to the state Medicaid program. Including the Medicaid population within a combined drug price negotiation program might negatively affect medical services and health outcomes because of that peculiar and very strong federal mandate. Nonetheless, and that all being said, pharma certainly recognizes the need for states like Oregon, which confront severe budgetary challenges, to explore creative public procurement alternatives and to be prudent purchasers of all state-procured products and services, including pharmaceuticals. And that is one of the reasons that in my testimony on the Senate Bill 324, I suggested that we would very much like to be part of a work group if that bill does go forward. Senate Bill 875-1, however, suffers from technical and fiscal flaws that we believe would undermine its policy objectives, and I'm going to discuss those briefly. Subsections 13C and 13E of the -1 amendments would broadly empower the administrator of the new Oregon Department of Administrative Services prescription drug program created by section 1 of the bill to, quote, purchase and distribute prescription drugs, unquote, to, among other groups and entities, quote, residents of Oregon with limited or no insurance coverage for prescription drugs, unquote, that's subsection 13C, and, quote, any other entity, unquote, public or private, in-state or out-of-state, that directly or indirectly purchases prescription drugs. By its terms, and despite the protestations of a contrary intent by the advocates, this provision would authorize the creation of tax-exempt government pharmacies with unlimited service charters that could compete on unequal terms with tax-paying private sector pharmacies already serving Medicare recipients, Medicaid recipients, and other private customers in Oregon. Section 3 of the bill would direct the Office of Oregon Health Plan, Health Policy and Research to develop and recommend to DAS a preferred drug list for use by participants in the prescription drug program created by Section 1 of the bill. The preferred drug list would be developed by using, quote, evidence-based evaluations on the effectiveness of similar prescription drugs, unquote, within particular therapeutic classes. Our concern here is that the, quote, evidence-based, unquote, drug evaluation process would simply parrot the findings and conclusions of the flawed practitioner-managed prescription drug plan drug evaluation process as it has been administratively implemented. And the basic problem, as several of you I know are aware, that has developed in the implementation of the PMPDP drug evaluation process is that OMAP not the Evidence-Based Practice Center at OHSU and not the Oregon Health Resources Commission, but OMAP has equated a lack of evidence of differential clinical effectiveness of drugs in a particular therapeutic class with a conclusion that in the absence of such evidence, in the absence of any evidence, all drugs in a particular class should be deemed to be equally effective, which we view as a complete misreading of the legislative intent behind Senate Bill 819. Section 2.4 of the bill would specifically authorize the use of prior authorization as a management tool for the new program. This subsection conflicts not only with the specific provisions of the legislation, Senate Bill 819, that created the PMPDP in 2001, but also with the longstanding Oregon statutory restriction of Medicaid prior authorization authority to the limited purpose of ensuring the clinical appropriateness of drugs dispensed to Medicaid recipients. It is not at all clear how the proponents of Senate Bill 875-1 intended that these three conflicting provisions would interact. On the merits of the issue of whether non-clinically focused prior authorization is detrimental to the welfare of Medicaid recipients, we commend to the committee's attention the attached Kaiser Family Foundation analysis of the negative impact of prior authorization provisions recently implemented in Michigan's Medicaid program. And finally, the bill would require a general fund appropriation in an unspecified amount to create working capital with which DAS would not only purchase pharmaceutical inventory, an expense that we dare say would be significant, but also make expenditures for a wide range of ancillary purposes, including paying for contracted service costs and computer costs. The basic objective of the bill, by its terms, and again contrary to the expressed intentions, which differ from those terms of the proponents, is to provide a generous supply of government venture capital in order to enable DAS to begin competing on unequal terms with tax-paying private Oregon pharmacies. In an era of extreme general fund shortfall, this would not appear to be the highest priority for new state general fund program expenditures.
Other than that, you like the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions?
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, again, for the record, Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. I'll try to move with some dispatch. Bulk purchasing of prescription drugs has been suggested here and in other states as a means to, you know, save states money in purchasing. As far as we know, no state or group of states has yet actually got something online, and so there are a lot of questions yet to be answered about the details of how we go about this. And while we don't have an objection in principle to bulk purchasing, this is the distribution of prescription drugs, and the whole purchasing system is very complex, and we're concerned that whatever we do here be done with extreme care and caution so that we don't have any unintended consequences in the distribution system. I have had an opportunity to review the -1 amendments, and so I'll speak mainly to those. And to the extent that the -1 amendments to 875 largely incorporate 324, I think you could take this to apply also to that bill. It's important to keep in mind that the way that the state would gain from a bulk purchasing mechanism would be primarily in the negotiation of rebates with manufacturers, as well as with some administrative efficiencies that might well be gained. Pharmacies and wholesalers both are operating at extremely thin margins, and it would be very important to have the appropriate firewalls and safeguards around such a program to make sure that we don't turn that part of the system upside down. We would suggest that DAS, if we have such a program, be the operator and not a pharmacy benefit manager contracted to operate it, in order to ensure that the state actually collects any rebates that are negotiated in whole. I've provided to the committee just a couple of many, many recent articles in the press about PBM practices. The second one of those I would point out is a more in way of an announcement from the Prescription Access Litigation Project and the AFSCME and AFL-CIO, which last month filed some major litigation against the four large PBMs, and I think their concerns are worth looking into. Beyond that, we have a number of technical concerns with the language in the dash ones, and I'll just run through that very briefly. One I've already covered, that we would prefer that such a system be done directly by DAS and not by a PBM. Secondly, there is a real question in this language about possession of the product and adjudication of inventory. The language as presented leaves open the possibility of the state actually taking possession, although I don't think that's the intent of the proponents. But if there is to be somehow an adjudication of inventory or a need for pharmacies to account for products dispensed through the program or not through the program, it may well be appropriate in any work group to bring the wholesalers into the process because they have a great deal of expertise in that area. We also object to the language referring to a network of pharmacies because that implies that some people would get to play and some people would not. And given that this is would be state purchasing and all of our members pay taxes to the state, they should be able to participate in any program concurrent with whatever, in agreement with whatever terms and conditions are given, in essence, any willing pharmacy provider. And then we would also suggest some work on the idea of limited prescription drug coverage. Every insurance policy that I know of has a limit at some point. And it would seem to me that seem to us more in terms of just policy that we ought to look at some parameters in terms of means test, some kind of a time limitation without coverage, perhaps 6 months. I don't know what the magic number is, but we certainly would not want to create an unintended consequence of particularly small employers who do have the option of carrying or not carrying prescription drug insurance from dropping that just to be able to get people into the program. And we would also suggest limiting this to state employees. Let's walk before we run. If we're going to do this, let's have a system that's up and operating at the state level before we invite the world in, and perhaps report back to the 05, 07 sessions as appropriate, and if at that time we want to add on that, then look at it then. We would just point out on page 3 there's some language about how a preferred drug list would be developed, would be required to be developed through a public hearing process. And while we believe that wherever the state is engaged in business, it should be as open as possible. If the state were to go through a process of selection for a preferred drug in any particular category and they say, aha, this is our preferred drug, the state has then lost all of its negotiating leverage. It's sort of like going and buying a car and saying, well, I'm willing to sell it to you for this much and offering there's not much negotiating leverage left. So we would like to see the state have some flexibility in how it approached that process. And last, we would suggest that some language be added so that we have assurance that pharmacies would in fact be reimbursed at the fair market value of the product, which is the largest component of our cost, plus a fair dispensing fee, so that we don't unintentionally turn the economics of pharmacies upside down. And then it also may be worth exploring for in terms of the uninsured, particularly seniors. There are federal matching funds available for Medicare Plus waivers, and I don't believe that the state has yet fully exploited that possibility. In the last session, Senator Menace, you were involved in Senate Bill 9, and that had a provision to at some point fund benefit, and my understanding is that there are now some funds from the federal government available, and We understand that these are very difficult times, and to talk about adding anything to a budget is somewhat problematic, but it may be desirable to at least create a framework to make that possible so that for those people who don't have any coverage, there could be some real benefit possibly provided utilizing those matching funds. As it now stands, the practical reality is that someone who lacks coverage, a discount on a very expensive drug doesn't really help them. They still can't afford it. So with that, I would be happy to take questions, happy to continue to work with the proponents on the particulars of language and take any questions you may have.
Questions?
I just have some questions, because I don't understand, and I don't know that anybody does.
I'm sorry, wait just a minute. I'll ask the participants or the in room, hearing room C, to please evacuate. We have a meeting there, and they're setting up the room for the next meeting at 3 o'clock, which Senator Starr and I will be at promptly, so we're going to cut this off fairly soon. But please leave hearing room C and come into this room if you want to hear the remaining discussion. Thank you.
Okay. Is there anybody out there who can explain this whole rebate process in bulk purchase in general? I mean, I think it's a very germane question. It's a very important question. And we have a pretty comprehensive bill here that purports to do a lot of stuff. But I don't understand and wouldn't begin to say I do the whole pharmaceutical bulk purchasing rebate process. Is there any... anybody that would venture into that territory?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I can... the part that I'm most familiar with is the Medicaid rebate, where a bargain was struck in the federal legislation which said there shall be open access to FDA-approved drugs. And in return for that, you, pharmaceutical manufacturer, are obligated to pay a rebate to the state Medicaid agency, which in turn is shared with the federal government in proportion to the federal match. A particular amount, and I believe it's 15.1%, and you are obligated to provide the Medicaid agency your best price that you provide any HMO and so forth, so that the Medicaid programs get the benefit of whatever Kaiser, for instance, is able to negotiate in terms of a price. And I think that's probably...
So, Mr. Chairman, again, if I understand correctly, then the Congress has reviewed this issue and understood or acknowledged that there are certain large groups that are currently able to negotiate a best price for a particular set of drugs with a particular number of manufacturers. So what they're suggesting then, and it sounds pretty complex to me, but they've acknowledged by this rebate process that they're going to level the playing field for states so that they would likewise get the best price that might be accomplished through that existing bulk purchase. So I guess it's interesting to me as we look at that flow of discussions. Again, I get kind of confused because I know that oncologists can actually purchase their drugs and be reimbursed. I think they purchase it like 20% of AWP, and then they're reimbursed at 80% of AWP. So they get a 60% spread on AWP as long as they administer the drugs inside their offices, which is an interesting thing. And the Congress acknowledged that disparity existed, but they acknowledged it saying that yes, we know it's there. We know that they have a tremendous benefit here. However, we also recognize our Medicaid reimbursement rates are pretty low, and so this is something that really offsets that. So, again, I'm saying all this to say that the entire picture relevant to bulk purchasing is a very obscure one, and the point I'm trying to make here is that if we did go down this road, how would we be able to demonstrate that there might be savings, as absent the whole question of setting up a state, tax-exempt pharmacy, et cetera, et cetera?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, then I'll turn it over to my colleague. I think it's a good question. I think that we would have no objection, and really in principle could not object to putting aside the Medicaid program, which has its own special characteristics because of that federal mandate, to state agencies aggregating their negotiating authority and being as prudent of purchasers as they could on the basic assumption of competitive economics that they ought to be able to negotiate if they wish en masse. I don't know. I think you raise a very interesting and difficult question as to what metric you would use to actually measure.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, it looks like we're commingling some complex mathematical equations, too. You're now commingling the Medicaid populations, for which Congress has already acknowledged a rebate process. But now if you bring in other individuals, self-insureds and other plans, state employees, I don't know what that does to the 15% rebate in general and how the Congress might acknowledge that or what that might do.
Chair Morissette, Senator Minnis, that's a very good question. One of the issues I know some of us have discussed is that in a bulk purchasing program by the state, it's very important to have a firm firewall between Medicaid and other purchasing, because otherwise the state's Medicaid rebate process can be compromised. To attempt to answer your question about sort of how these rebates work in the private sector, which is analogous to what we'd be talking about here, there is, as you're aware, the average wholesale price is a reference price for any particular drug, and it's a published figure. And all pharmacy and insurance contracts involving prescription drug benefits work off of that reference. So what happens is, as a practical matter, the pharmacy contracts with a wholesaler or through its buying group for a certain discount off of AWP for its purchasing.
I have to interrupt for just a moment. Some of you came to testify, and if you have written testimony, please turn it in and we will distribute your testimony. We do plan to have another hearing. We are going to have a work group, and it will meet at 5:30 on Thursday. And Bruce Goldberg, Lynn Marie Kreider, Jim Gardner, Tom Holt, Senator Minnis, myself, and perhaps Senator Carter and Senator Morris, and there may be others involved, and the room will be announced because we don't have an opportunity, we'll figure out the room. This has been a very good hearing. And we will continue with this and hopefully work something out. Now, I'm sorry for interrupting. Did you want to finish your statement?
Well, to be very brief, what the rebates essentially do, because there is great sensitivity amongst the industry about who got what particular deal, what the rebates essentially function as is a way to adjudicate what those agreements actually are without having them out for the whole world to see, is probably the best way I can describe it.
All right.
I'll be happy to talk with you some more about that.
Good. And with that, we will close the public hearing. Thank you for being here, and I'm sorry that we didn't have...